Our democracy is hanging by a thread, but we know it's not about just winning and losing each battle. It's about persistence and building resilience.
That's why we're launching the Practivist Pod, the practice of activism made practical.
If you're looking for ways to get engaged or just for ways to stay sane, we want to help you navigate what comes next.
It's an exciting collaboration with political dynamo Jess Craven, author of the Chop Wood, Carry Water newsletter,
and grassroots activist Steve Pearson, host of the How We Win podcast.
Every week on the Practivist Pod, we're going to have important conversations with changemakers, give you practical ways to make an impact, have some fun, and inspire hope.
This is more than a podcast. It's a place for our community to grow our practice of advocacy for justice, equity, and progress.
Action is the best antidote for anxiety. So subscribe to the Practivist Pod today.
Welcome to the Start Me Up podcast, part of MSW Media and the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. I'm your host, Kimberly Johnson in DC. Today, my returning guest is author Ann Werner, and she is my mother. We're going to be talking about her latest trilogy, After the Apocalypse. We're also going to be talking about some of the good news we're hearing and just some fun stories from our lives. But before we get into it,
the Start Me Up podcast is independent, listener-funded, and woman-run. Visit patreon.com/startmeup to see the variety of tiers offered, including the option to get a bonus What's Up episode every Tuesday. It's kind of like my online journal where I get a little more personal and I talk about whatever's on my mind. There's also an ad-free tier with a much shorter intro. Just visit patreon.com/startmeup.
Now please enjoy my conversation with author Ann Werner. Welcome back to the show, Anne, Mom.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Okay, well, you were here not that long ago because your first book, well, it wasn't your first book, it was your third book, The Augurs.
The Augurs came out. The third book was The Adepts.
Oh, I'm sorry, The Adepts. Okay, so when did The Adepts come out?
Last summer.
Okay, and now we've got After the Apocalypse.
Yes, right? And that's a compendium. It's a box set, as they say, but it's a compendium of all three. It's called After the Apocalypse, the Complete Series.
All right. I just started talking about your book and I didn't even say anything else. I was like, okay. Come on, let's talk about your book. So we'll talk about your book in a second because I just started too fast. I should have just like had a little fun intro and I didn't even think about that. But so we'll just kind of do the little fun intro a little late.
Oh, okay. All right.
But obviously this is my mother. And for those of you who have listened to the show for a while, you're familiar with her. And so, yeah, we're going to talk about her book a little bit and then we're going to get into some good news, just the good news. And then because I can't take the bad news right now, there's too much of it. So we're only going to talk about some of the good news. And then I've just got some crazy, weird, fun questions, stories from, you know, our past, our shared past, which is since I was born, which is our shared past. Okay. So let's get, because it's After the Apocalypse is the trilogy. It's the box set and that's out right now. So let's just kind of go back and review the whole series. Tell everybody, first of all, when you started writing it, which is funny, and, you know, obviously not giving away the plots and all of the spoilers, but, you know, just talk about the series and then lead us up to the box set.
Okay, well, I was living in Sonoma County at the time when I got the idea, and I started writing it in 2016. And I got an idea because one of my favorite books was On Writing by Stephen King, because I love Stephen King. And I was so happy when I found out that he just, you know, he'll sit around and just think about stuff and go, what if? And I just thought, what if there was a global pandemic? And really, truly, that's how that book started. And it was very different from what it wound up being. I mean, I had it set in Northern California, and they were and my protagonists were going to escape on a boat and out in the Pacific. And I thought, I don't know anything about the boats or the Pacific, you know, so. Then I sold my place and I moved back here
to the East Coast.
Yes, I moved back to Maryland and I signed for my house on a day that shall forever live in infamy, the day that Donald Trump was inaugurated the first time. So,
Boo, boo.
yeah, I know, boo hiss. And I got away from it. I had written all this stuff, and then I thought, well, I'm gonna change things around. And so I set it in a different thing, and I wound up with reindeer herders in the Northern Mongolian steppe. I didn't even know there was such a thing as reindeer herders. It's interesting because our mutual friend, Lorraine, Devin Wilkie, she did a Substack the other day, and or maybe last week, and she was saying that you learn a lot from reading fiction, and that's really true. A lot of people, they go, "Oh, I only read nonfiction." But what people who don't write don't understand is that when people write a fictional book, even in the most crazy scenarios, okay, you always have to do research in order to make it believable to people that they buy into what, your scenario. And so, and when you do that, you wind up learning things. You learn, and like I said, I never I the fact that there was a tribe of there is a tribe, the Dakha, in the Northern Mongolian steppe, and that's what they are. They're reindeer herders, and they've lived that way for 3,000 years. There's only about 300 of them, and I wiped them out in my book. Okay, that was the beginning of
The
the
melt,
book. Yes, itself of the melt. Yeah. So from there, it went to all the crazy crap that would happen with something that was unstoppable like that. And of course, this was even before the real pandemic happened. I just saw what was happening, and so I incorporated what we were going through with that hideous turn of events in 2017. And I had a Trumpian kind of a character in it as the president. And then I just, and then it was the chaos and all that stuff. And then they, my protagonists, this young couple, Ethan and Rena Hampton,
Kind of like Bob and me.
kind of like Bob and you, yes. He was a tall, handsome Italian guy and a California blonde. I don't know where I got those characters from. So, but they bought a house, and the house had a bomb shelter, and that's how they survived the pandemic. So then it was like the first book, The Melt, was in two parts. It was part one called The Red Scourge, and that was what they called the disease. And then there was the second part was New Hope. And New Hope was set actually in Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, and they renamed it New Hope. So it was just their whole, it was their whole thing. They found some other survivors. They built this, and it was like 25, 30 people. They built this fledgling little settlement in Harper's Ferry, and then, I always take everybody, every writer I've ever known and ever read always takes stuff from real life. And so my real life stuff is you're always seeing these things about these preachers, okay? These right-wing preachers who are really, so many of them are really terrible people. You see it all the time. They're always being arrested for pedophilia and all sorts of things. We won't go into all of them, but I don't have to tell you, everybody knows. So I incorporated that kind of a thing. I brought that kind of a character because you always need some kind of a conflict. And so then from there, when I went into the second book, people started to discover that they were having psychic experiences. Now, I am a firm believer in psychic ability only, and I think it is a lost art of humanity because, and just one of the explanations that one of the characters gave in the book was, and that was the augurs. That's why it was called. And thanks again, to Lorraine for handing me that title because she was one of my readers and she suggested that. And it was perfect. But I think the advent of mass communication has blunted the psychic abilities that I think every human has. I think it's part of us. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not that, you know, we can't tell who, you know, the lottery numbers and stuff like that. Yeah. But I think a lot of times we have experiences like Rena did in the first book. She had an experience when they walked into the bomb shelter, and it was like this feeling of foreboding, and she dismissed it because that's what we do when we have these feelings. And then, you know, but then sometimes what happens, like what happened to me in spades, okay, I had a vision one time, and you well know about this. Okay, I had a vision. I was going to school full time, going to college full time, and working full time. And I was going to LACC, Los Angeles Community College, or Los Angeles City College. And it is situated on Vermont Avenue, which is an extremely busy street. And I never, ever wanted to park on Vermont Avenue because it was an extremely busy street. It was a main thoroughfare that went through LA County all the way down into Orange County. And I don't know where the hell it ended, maybe in Mexico. So I was looking, I was always on side streets, and I couldn't find a side street, and I'm late for class, and I'm driving around. I'm thinking, God damn. I found one parking space, and the parking space was about three blocks away from school, and it was on Vermont Avenue, and the parking space was all alone, and it was between a red zone in the front of the parking space where you couldn't park, and then it was a driveway coming out of a Taco Bell behind the parking space. So I park the car and I'm hurrying and I get out of the car. And when I close the door to the car, I had a vision. And the vision was that my car was bent in half. And I thought, I'm just paranoid because it's Vermont Avenue. And I went scurrying off to my classes. Well, a couple hours later, I come back up, scurrying up the street because now I got to go to work. And this tow truck goes by with his car. And I'm thinking, And, you know, you think, boy, that's a mess. That car is a real wreck. So then I get a little closer and I'm thinking, there's another tow truck just around where my car is. Walking further, I'm thinking, oh my God, a tow truck is there for my car. Well, my car was now in the red zone in front of where it had been parked, and it was bent in half. Mm-hmm. I mean, the roof was bent in half. And this was not a small car. This was not a little crap car. It was a 1986 Mercury Cougar. It was a beautiful car because I was in the car business at the time, and it had been my demo, and I liked that car so much that I bought it. Mm-hmm. And because some guy took a test drive in it he smoked a cigar in it. And I was so pissed. So that's why I bought it. So this was not a small car. This was not a tan car. All right. The trunk was wrapped around the rear wheels. Oh my God. I mean, that car was hit. And, you know, to this day, it pisses me off. That insurance company that I had at the time did not total that car. The frame was bent. Mm-hmm. And from that day onward, whenever it rained on the driver's side, that car would leak because they couldn't completely, you know, pull the damage out of the frame. It had a bent frame. Other than that, it was a great car, and I kept it to 100,000 miles. But I mean, I saw what happened before it happened. Mm-hmm. So that, I just know. And there are other times when, you know, people, you'll think of somebody and boom,
they call you or something.
They call you right then. And I mean, that has happened so many times. Well, so I think that there is that everybody has that ability, but it's been really just smothered with all of the technology we have. So going back to the book, okay, I think that, you know, this is, you know, nobody figured what's happening because it's happening to everybody. Mm-hmm. Some people more, some people less, but everybody is starting to get these little twinges. And it starts where some people see this woman or they hear this woman coming towards them. So then it's this whole thing, because the mad preacher from the first book who had been expelled. Okay, well, he's angry and he wants something, and so he comes back for it. So that's that book. And then the last book, I had an idea when I first started writing it what the cause of the Red Scourge was. And I decided in the last book that at the very end, I would let people know what it was. So, but, you know, again, it's just about the struggles. I mean, the thing is with in my books, okay, there are no monster trucks racing across.
Really?
The
there's
desert.
No monster trucks in your books?
I know. I, unbelievable. Because, you know, there's no damn place to get gasoline. They don't have any refineries. Okay. There are no more monster trucks. And, you know, so it's how would people from very disparate, and I mean, you know, you have this young liberal couple and they're moving to a place like West Virginia, okay, where they don't know what they're going to find, but they moved there because his dad had a vacation cabin there. And so that's where they decided to stay, to get out of the city where it was just dead people everywhere and the stench was unbelievable. So, you know, I just try to take my books and they're kind of, and yeah, a lot of it, it is a statement on the way we treat each other, mm-hmm. and the way that people would cope.
Yeah.
When I advertise the book, because in the third book, in the final one, The Adepts, there is a truly, truly evil character. The preacher in my beginning books, he was not a good man. Don't get me wrong. He did some awful things. And he was, you know, he was very much like the preachers that you hear about today. Okay. But there is a driving force. And so the driving force is he shows up. And I just try to take situations that I think people would actually face in a situation like that. And just how would people conduct themselves? How would they build a society, and what kind of a society would they build? And I mean, all of my writing, whatever book I've ever written, okay, even my serial killer books, I mean, that's what they're all about. They're all about the emotional impact, because I think every writer wants to have an emotional impact with their readers. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I always strive for. And I'll sit there in front of my computer and I'll be writing scenes and I'll either be laughing hysterically or I'll be crying or I'll be angry. I mean, I really get into my characters. Hmm. And I really do thank Wayne Dvorak.
Mm-hmm. Our acting coach.
Acting coach. Okay. And everything I learned during the Meisner technique and everything that I employed as an actor, it really adds to my writing experience, because boy, I really know how to get into a character, and that's what I'll do. I'll just sit there and let it take off. And, you know, sometimes I write crap and I get rid of the crap, but the one thing that I've always remembered is, you know, sometimes you hit a wall and you don't know what the right, you're thinking, I don't know what the hell to do. But if you just keep on doing it, mm-hmm. and even if what you're writing is garbage, somewhere in that garbage, you're going to find a little pearl. Mm-hmm. You throw everything out and you keep the pearl and you run with that. So, you know, but the way I describe this book, and I think, because I was trying to come up with a way to advertise it. And I thought, you know what? Okay, there's Earth Abides, all right, which I read years ago. And it was written, I think, back in the 40s. And it was about a pandemic. All right. So I read that, and they've made I think it's on Apple, a series called Earth Abides. So it's Earth Abides meets All the President's Men and The Handmaid's Tale. Hmm. And I think that's a really good description of this whole trilogy.
So well, I've read the whole trilogy and I like it, but I don't know if people are going to listen to me because I'm your daughter. But I will say
this. They should.
I will say, I mean, obviously you've had a gazillion different professions, and I believe, you know, you've been an actress, you've literally been a clown at kids' parties. You've sold cars, you've been a bartender. I mean, there's a gazillion different things you've done. But of all the things you've done, I think, you know, and I say this genuinely, I think your writing is the best. And part of it is because you've been, well, part of it is because you're kind of like this. You're an Aries and a perfectionist, and you have read your whole life. So, you know, you've always been an avid reader, and, you know, obviously you're creative. So all those, and then like, yeah, because you were in acting class, which I want to talk about something from our acting class in a minute. But, and I actually have it on my notes, but, yeah, I mean, I think
I think writing is actually the only thing I've ever stuck with.
Yeah, it is.
I've ever stuck with. And
I mean, you stuck with acting, but then you just decided you didn't want
to.
Yeah,
but I mean, it was for a time. I've been writing really, truly all of my life. I mean, when I was a sophomore in high school, we had to write a autobiography. Okay. I didn't do a paper. I did a freaking booklet and I had it illustrated.
Yeah, the Anne Sam Werner story, right?
Yep. That was it.
And then and it was like perfect. And then there was me.
No. Oh, don't sell yourself short.
Well,
you used to write great papers about drugs in school. I know. You did.
And about how my cat has gas. Talk about crass. I never knew a smell like that could come from such a little cat.
I love you had a poem when you were little. Beautiful butterfly with beautiful wings.
No, wait. Beautiful butterfly with colorful wings.
Yeah, with colorful wings makes me think of beautiful things.
When the beautiful butterfly flutters away, it goes on to another day.
Yes.
I think I wrote that when I was like 8.
I know. You were just a little kid. Here's my favorite Kimberly story, and I'm going to tell it anyway. One time, Kimberly was being really horrible. And she... we just brought her a bed because she kept crawling out of her crib. I'm talking to your audience, not you, so you can just go have a coffee or something. Anyway, I needed peace and quiet because all day long I'd been running after a 2.5-year-old. And you kept on getting out of bed and kept on getting out of bed. And finally, I was so angry because it was like the 10th time. And I was just trying to watch something on TV and decompress from all day long being with a toddler. And you get out and I take you back and I put you in that bed and I said, damn it, Kimberly, you stay in this bed because if you don't, I'm going to spank your fanny so hard it's going to bleed. And you turn around and you looked at me with this look on your face and you went, what are you going to do? Crack it open? Just like that. This is a little toddler. It completely disarmed me. I burst out laughing. So, okay, Kimberly's audience, if you wondered where she got all that from, it wasn't from me. She just born that way.
I was just born. Well, that kind of reminds me, we were talking about this the other day. It's not so much the sarcasm, but you and I know this woman, Mary, and Mary has these two little girls. And so one of her little girls, Anime, I was watching her babysitting her, and she's probably about 5 or 6. And so she was used to having breakfast burritos. So she, you know, she told me how to make the breakfast burrito, and she was telling me all the things to add in and everything. So I made the breakfast burrito, but I think it was just a little too big. And I served it to her. And she just, the look on her face, she just looked at me and she goes, this is the worst breakfast burrito I've ever had. It's like the things that kids say. So, I mean, I'm definitely one of them. But you know what? Real quick, we have to do a little bit of an ad and a break. So we will be back after this message. Hey, this is Kimberly, the host of the show you're listening to right now. If you're having a good time and you want to become a patron, please go to patreon.com/startmeup. Check out all the tiers and become a patron today. Thank you so much. Okay, we are back. All right, so let's see. Let's talk a little bit. I don't want to talk too much.
All right.
But I do want to talk about some of the good news. And I'm going to read something to you because this was in Bloomberg. And it said, Cory Booker's 25-hour speech was a stunt and it worked. So it says, Booker can help rebrand his party as less risk-averse and more willing to try. Something. That's something. He can rebrand himself just as the old ineffective guard falters. Booker's speech was raw and visceral and real and angry. He did something. Now his colleagues and American voters must do more. So I just want to kind of talk about this because he's so amazing. I fucking love him. And of course, you know, my friend Stephanie has pictures of him because Stephanie meets everybody. you know, Steph Walton. She meets everybody and she's super excited about fucking everything. So there's pictures of her on her Instagram. And it's so cute because it was her and her husband and they had met Corey. And of course, Corey is like so amazing. So like both of those two together, can you imagine what it must have been like to be standing there with, because they're both so positive and both such like happy, charismatic people. But anyway, so yeah, I think that it was extremely heartwarming. And I was, you know, you and I, obviously we talk every day. And so I had said to you at some point, and then I think I reiterated it yesterday, that initially when this election happened, I think, you know, and then on top of it, when we started seeing how quickly things were going south, there was kind of like the shock and awe with the Democratic Party. I think like everybody was just standing there going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Yeah. And nobody really knew what to do. There were a few people who have been there from day one, AOC, Chris Murphy, Jasmine Crockett, you know, Eric Swalwell has been at it for a long time. They I think have a really good grasp on messaging, but then, you know, the rest of the party, you know, we've been seeing a few people here like Tim Walz emerging. And so now I think with Cory Booker doing this, I think it's opening up a door, and perhaps other people in the Democratic Party are going to experience a sense of fear of missing out, FOMO. They want to, you know, get in on this, and maybe it's inspiring to them. So, I mean, I just want to hear, you know, your take on this, and what do you think is like, what do you think can come from this?
Well, I mean, it is up to our elected representatives. And so we have to let them know, you know, you better get on it.
Yeah.
They do respond to threats.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not talking about, you know, threats of bodily harm, but threats of losing their jobs. Mm-hmm. And I think really, truly the Democratic Party, I think one of the things that a lot of these guys are doing are going to these town halls wherever the Republican representatives refuse to show up because they're scared of their constituents.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah.
That is crazy shit to be afraid to talk to your constituents. And then when they do, because I'm sure that a lot of people listening in have seen the videos, they berate the people or talk down to them.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's like, this is not how to win friends and influence people. So I think that Democrats should be doing that, and they should be, you know, they don't even have to go in their own state. Okay. Like people from, you know, representatives from Maryland go into West Virginia.
Yeah.
Because let me tell you something, those people in West Virginia are really going to be hurting hard.
Mm-hmm.
That's a poor state. It's a beautiful state. It's beautiful and it's big and it's got so much to offer, but nobody wants to live there because you can't make a living there.
Yeah.
And now you're not going to be able to buy food. But I'm really wondering, you know, this whole thing with Booker's speech that was so, I mean, there were people, I saw, I think on Blue Sky the other day, there was somebody was commenting to one of the posts that he had made after the speech. And they said that they listened for 11 hours. Now, throughout the day, mm-hmm. I know just everybody was tuning into Corey.
Yeah.
And that was throughout the day and throughout the night. Insomniacs were tuning into him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I think that I just think there is something happening here. Just like that old, there's something
happening here.
Yeah.
And what it is ain't exactly clear. But yeah, I mean, I do. I think that was.
There are people waiting. Okay. They're waiting. They are waiting for somebody to come and say,
yes,
you know, but there are also these people where it's just baked in that anything that Trump says is like from the mouth of God.
Right. Exactly.
It doesn't matter that he can say two opposite things in the same sentence. They'll believe both of them at the same time. It really is a form of mental illness. Mm-hmm. It truly is.
Yeah. So, I mean, and I think, okay, so let's pull this over to the Wisconsin win. And you and I talked about this briefly this morning, and I just want you to kind of go over how this benefits everybody as opposed to just Wisconsin.
Oh, well, the thing is, you know, Wisconsin's always been a swing state.
Mm-hmm.
So the last justice that they had was a Democrat, was a liberal. Okay. And now that person's gone And so they're replacing that person. And to put a Republican would have changed the balance of power. Mm-hmm. Well, what the Supreme Court in Wisconsin did when they had, you know, the Democratic majority, and now they still do, they busted the gerrymander in there. It was a thing about abortion, okay, because otherwise they would have kicked in 1800s law and they would have outlawed abortion in Wisconsin. That would have just been Wisconsin. But nationwide, that has always been one of those swing states. And it was gerrymandered in favor of Republicans that Democrats could win in like congressional elections. Mm-hmm. And yet the Republicans would have more seats in their.
Yeah.
Republicans would have more seats. So they just made it. So they made it. So it was impossible for Democrats to win. And that's really important when you get into elections like for president and for the House of Representatives. They made it impossible. So this way it is, it's a boon for the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have, and I will say this, Maryland is gerrymandered heavily, mm-hmm. heavily for Democrats, mm-hmm. which obviously in this day and age is really a good thing. But right. I just think gerrymandering should be outlawed. I just think that really, because really when you have these states that are gerrymandered up to the sky,
yeah.
all right, the vote really does not count. It really doesn't count mm-hmm. because they manipulate it.
Yeah.
So I just think that, you know, I mean, I know that was in the legislation that Democrats tried and failed to pass in the Biden years. And, you know, and Democrats were obviously at fault for that because they could have done it because they had the majority the first 2 years. And they didn't because Democrats are afraid, too, of losing seats. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that isn't fair, okay? If you live in a red area and you want a red guy, you should be able to vote for the red person. But, you know, you shouldn't be somebody living in a blue area who, they, you know, but because the guy across the street is in the red area.
Right.
You know, it just...
And yeah, this, it's dumb.
His blue vote is negated. So it doesn't... It's not fair.
Right.
And it's not a democracy when you do that. And everything has just been so, everything has been so diluted. And all of these people talking about how, screaming about the Constitution, they love to do that. Scream about the Constitution. They're shredding it.
Yeah.
So, you know, fuck them and their so-called respect for the Constitution. Fuck them and their so-called respect for our military, mm-hmm. where they're taking away. I mean, God, the VA was already underfunded. And now they've just gotten rid of it. We're not going to talk about negative things.
And then I just think of my father because he's a veteran.
I know.
He got cancer because of Agent Orange. You know, it's like whenever
to this day, he suffers from PTSD.
Yes.
Because he was a freaking child when they shipped his sorry ass off to Vietnam. And he was only there for 7 months before he got sent home grievously injured when he spent a year in the hospital, 6 months as an inpatient, 6 months as an outpatient. And he's very fortunate that they were able to put him back together. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he has his arms, he's got his legs. He could have been killed.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, he lost the use of his arm for a long time, but his arm is what saved him mm-hmm. because he was in a firefight and something exploded near him and he put his arm up over his head and that's what saved him because a piece of shrapnel went right through his arm
mm-hmm.
and there was shrapnel that went through it and got into his head.
Yeah.
But just on the surface, because mm-hmm. it was stopped by his arm, but it shattered all the nerves in his arm. And, you know, I mean, I think he was injured like right around on his 22nd birthday.
Yeah, which is right when I was born.
Yes, yes.
And then there's the famous...
You got the notice that you'd been born because we notified the Red Cross.
Right.
And then he called and he didn't even know that you'd been born yet. But he called from the hospital in Tokyo to say he was coming home. And then
he did come home and you were holding me, the first thing you said was, look at her feet.
Because I have big feet.
That was in the hospital, yeah. They brought you, and like, oh, my cute little baby. I thought it was your leg.
That's the story we hear every family gathering. Everyone has to talk about my big feet. Okay.
Well, it was just a harbinger of things to come because, my God, you know, 6 feet tall. What can I say?
I know, 6 feet tall. All right.
I knew you weren't going to be a shrimp.
No, I wasn't. But I just have to bring this up because, okay, I want to talk a little bit about the acting class. Both of us went to an acting studio and studied the Meisner technique, and it was the most awesome experience for both of us. And I think you left before I did, but it was about 8 years you were there, and I was there about 8 years. So anyway, one of the things that we used to have to do, it was just an exercise, and it was it was like an improv exercise, but it was, we would communicate with this thing called repetition. Yeah. And repetition is if, like, I were to say, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and then, well, we can do it back and forth right now. We can demonstrate.
Yeah, okay, so I'll start. Okay. I'm afraid.
You're afraid.
I'm afraid.
You're afraid.
You sound curious.
I'm curious.
I'm not curious. You're supposed to repeat.
You sound curious.
You're supposed to repeat me.
That's true.
It's been a while.
Well, I know, but... Okay, if you're going to criticize your mother, you shouldn't say you sound curious. You have to talk about how you feel. That's why I fell off the wagon.
Okay, well, but ultimately here,
back and forth and back and forth.
Yeah, you know? I sound curious. You sound curious. I sound, you know, it's like you have to repeat at least once, and then
you know your emotion changes.
Right, and then it just has to be focused on what you're feeling, what you think the other person is feeling, or you can comment on something visual, but you're not supposed to say things like "fuck you" because you, instead of saying "fuck you," you would say "I'm angry with you." Yeah, you just express your emotion. So anyway, we would do these exercises, and it would be two people, and there would be one person in front of the class, and they would be doing an activity. And the activity usually had some kind of my acting coach would call it like a 200-pound weight, like an urgency to it. And so then somebody would knock on the door and take you out of your activity, and then you'd have your back and forth with your repetition. So... the reason I'm bringing this up, and I know exactly that you're going to know what I'm talking about, but I was just watching an interview with Murray Bartlett, who played he was on White Lotus. He was the original cast, the first season of White Lotus, and he was the hotel concierge.
I just love him.
And so, you know, he took a shit in the luggage of one of the characters. And so... Yeah. I saw him being interviewed about that, and it was CG. It looked very real, but it was CG. And then I guess before they did it CG, the prop department made poop. So he was talking about, and this is what reminded me of you, because one of your activities was making poop.
I had made poop.
Made poop. So and I'll be really quick. So Murray said, I want you to describe how you made yours and what happened, but... Oh my God, it kind of grossed me out because he said that their prop department made poop out of like chocolate and caramel. I can't imagine what the caramel was for.
Oh God.
It like puts a whole new twist on it. But you, like, what was your activity with poop? I wasn't there because we were in different classes.
I was there. I don't know. I was angry at somebody and I was going to. My whole thing was I was angry. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to take this poop and I'm going to put it in a bag and, you know, set it on fire and ring their bell and, you know.
Yeah.
That kind of a thing. That was my intention and thing. So I'm getting everything all ready and I've got this poop that I'd made and I made the poop out of flour and soy sauce.
And it looks real.
And it really looked like poop. And when I was... finished, okay, when Wayne, our coach, called time, he goes, oh my God, I could smell that. I went, Wayne, it's soy sauce and flour. It's not real shit.
Oh my God. And I was not there because that was when you were, we did what was called the professional level together, but then we studied separately.
Yeah, You started after I started. Because, you know, I would have people over the house and we'd be doing rehearsals and Kimberly was there and she's thinking, ooh.
Yeah, I totally wanted to do it. I remember I sat in on one of the one of the rehearsals.
Steve. Yeah, maybe with Steve.
Yeah, and then but it was also
I rehearsed with a bunch of the people.
Yes, there was an Asian guy, and there I can't remember.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I can't remember his name, but I think I don't know what I said to him, but I had so much fun. And then I remember that's when I went and I talked to Wayne, and he took me in.
His name, but boy, did he was a snappy dresser.
Yes, he was. And that was such a fun class. In fact, one of the graduates, now he graduated way before us, but he would come back to our acting studio, and his name is Steven Sears, but he was the writer-producer of Xena Warrior Princess. So it's like, yeah. I know all over, Xena is still something people talk about. And yeah. Like she's in all the comms and everything, all the comic comms or whatever. And it's not my world, but yeah. But I'm friends with Steven on Facebook. And yeah, it was like just such a great experience. We always, both of us have always kind
it
of.
It was one of the best of my life. Yeah. It truly was. It truly was.
Yeah.
I had great experiences in my life, but that is definitely way, way up at the very top of the list, because it was fun.
Scary. It was a little scary.
You got to do things you would never do.
Mm-hmm. With no judgment. Like you could just, there was this one guy, you never had to do this, but I don't know why.
I was pissed off too, because I was really looking forward to it.
Yeah, because there was this thing called Outrageous. And the way he introduced it to us the first time, because we were in different classes. So, you weren't in my class when he did this. But anyway, so he told us like that night, he was like, all right, do something so outrageous and everybody in the class has to vote you as outrageous. And if you don't get voted outrageous, you still have to keep going. And I know I failed. Like I failed the first because I didn't know what to do. I was like on the spot. And I think people were just like, oh my God, she's boring. So let's just say she's outrageous and get rid of her. But I, eventually when I had time, because then we did it as an activity where you would come in and you would do something outrageous. But there was this one guy who, I was not in this class. It was a different class. So I didn't see this. But, everybody talked. So there was this guy who put chocolate pudding on his asshole. Well, maybe not on his hole, but like he put it on his ass and then he smeared chocolate pudding all over his butt. And then I don't know if the people in class knew it was chocolate pudding, and I don't know when he smeared it on his butt, but he took a spoon and he like took it off his butt with the spoon and ate it. That was the most fun class because my outrageous was basically I wore all white. So I had white leggings and a white t-shirt, and I wanted to talk. I was pretending that I was talking to, I think, my grandmother, who I don't think she really had much, let's say, I don't want to say hope. I don't think she thought I was going to get very far. Like she didn't think I should be acting, because everybody, they all think you have to go to school and become a doctor, all that shit. And it's like, oh no, she's going to be an actor. So, I wanted to be sarcastic to her. So I brought my Raggedy Ann doll and I put it as if it were my grandmother, and I put fake blood on my coming out of my nipples and fake blood all over my crotch area. And I started performing a punk rock song. And then I started, oh, that's right. No, I'm sorry. I didn't use Raggedy Andy as my grandmother. I humped Raggedy Andy. Raggedy Andy. Yeah. And so, I remember it was so funny because when I did that, the way our acting coach would laugh, he would do this weird thing with his hands. And it was like, he would take the back of his hands and his fingers would be just like pushed out and he'd like push on his eyes. I don't know what that was all about. I was like,
it was eyes, and it was like, I think up around his sinuses.
Yes, he was like releasing his sinuses or something.
Yeah. Oh my God.
And you knew that you were funny if you made him do that.
Yeah.
So he was doing that. He's like, you need to work an outrageous more. But you never got to do it. You never got to do it. That was like, scammed out of it.
I was so disappointed. It was like, dude, come on. He said, oh, we're not going to do it anyway. It's like, What? I never got my chance. I was really disappointed because I know one time I had an activity. You mentioned that I used to do clown work, and so I had a whole clown outfit that I made. Okay, mm-hmm. I had the wig, I had the whole nine yards. So I decided I was gonna do a strip tease. And I was gonna, but I was starting out in the clown outfit. So I'm, you know, and I've got, you can leave your hat on.
Right.
Okay, playing in the whole nine yards. And the knock came too soon. And it's like, damn,
oh,
it,
man,
my striptease.
That sucks, man. But that was like the most fun thing ever. I'm so grateful that you found, because you're the one who found him. Yeah. And then, you know, like you said, I joined a little bit later. I was in a different class, but, yeah. And then when we graduated, then we all came together and formed what was called the, the professional level. So
yeah.
Anyway, but that was so much fun. And okay, I want to ask a couple more questions. We've got a little bit more time, but I'm just going to say, and these are just random. The one thing doesn't have to do with the other. So I'm just going all around. But I would say, what's the worst thing you did as a teenager compared to the worst thing I did? Like, what do you consider the worst thing you did? And then compared, like, how bad was it in comparison to whatever you consider my worst thing was?
I can't even compete with you, Kimberly.
I know, you were a goody two-shoes.
I was, but I had my moments. We went to I was dating your father at the time. And so we went to a party, and it was in the wintertime, and I had a coat. So I was wearing a coat. So everybody just kind of like threw their coats in, you know, the bedroom. And then, I don't know, we went somewhere. I can't remember. We left the party for some reason, but I left my coat there because we weren't going for, I don't know what we did. Maybe we're going to go, you know, get beer or something from somebody that would buy it for us. Although I never drank because I was a goody douche. But when we came back, the place had been raided, and now we had my coat wasn't there because the police booked everything. So that there was that, you know, I went to a party like that, but I really was, I was, I
and
really
then there was me.
I know. Then there was you, but you know, honestly, Kimberly,
I wasn't
so
that bad.
Made up for it for the adolescence that I had that lasted until I was 45 years old. So
that's
true. I've done some things that, quite frankly,
well, see,
I'll
okay,
never
when
tell
you were a teenager,
about.
Yeah, when you were a teenager, you were pretty good. But then, yeah, I remember like you almost got arrested for piracy, and Dad almost filmed it.
I was so glad that he wasn't working that night. Oh my God, I was so glad. I would have lost you. And well, that you know, and the only reason we weren't arrested was because one of the people was okay, the story was this. My sister called me, and she had a fight with her husband, and she said, I'm moving to California. And I thought, oh my God, this is ridiculous. And I said, well, you know what? No, just hang on there. Let me, you know, I was working at a electrical contractor, and I said, I'll just come over after work, and I'll pick you up, and we'll go out, and we'll talk about it. So I figured I would take her to this bar down in downtown Baltimore called O. Henry's on Mount Vernon Place. And so I went, and I picked her up, and we went, and we're having beer, and the place was empty, okay, because it was, you know, it was just after work. It was maybe about 5 o'clock. People really weren't there yet. So we're sitting there, and we're drinking, and, you know, pitchers of beer and everything, and my sister's getting loaded, and she's, you know, she's complaining about her husband, this, that, and the other thing. And this guy walks in, and he slithers up next to my sister, who is now drunk. And he's putting the moves on her and everything. And then somebody comes by the table. Oh, I think it was the owner of the bar, this guy named Jack, and who was a real horrible person. He was a bum, but I had a thing for him. So... He said, hey, you know, we're going to have a party down at the harbor tonight. Christ, I hope. Well, it's the statute of limitations has passed. Anyway, it was on a submarine, which is still there, the USS Torso. Okay, so it's like, oh, okay. So my sister wanted to go, and it was like, no, you're not going. So I take her home to her drunken husband. I call my mother because I was living with my mother at the time because – well, that's a whole story. But at any rate, I was in between places at the time. It was right after your father and I broke up. And I said, I'll just be late. So I go back. And so this guy that had been, you know, I go back to the bar. And so the guy that had put in the moves on my sister, he wasn't there yet. But then he comes walking in, all right. And he's wearing a blue chiffon evening gown. And he's got, you know, like when you were a kid in first grade and you had a good paper and they put gold stars on your paper. Okay, well, he had them pasted all over his forehead. I'm thinking, okay, this is interesting. So anyway, we all get in this little, in Jack's little sports car, a little two-seater. So I'm sitting up front with him. And then, you know, this other guy, his name is Scott, in the blue evening gown. He was like stuffed behind the seats. There was a space, I guess, for luggage or whatever. And we went and we picked up this guy who worked, his name was Gussie. And he worked in one of the, you know, Chi-Chi restaurants downtown. We picked him up. And off we go. All right, so we go there, and the submarine was not locked. We just went up the gangplank, and we just lifted the hatch, and we went in there. Well, you know, we got the radio working, and we brought a whole bunch of booze with us, and Jack had left $500. He owned the bar, and so he left $500 for bail money, just in case anything happened. So we're all partying and this, that, and the other thing. And we hear noises up on the deck. And we're thinking, oh, what's that? Because we went around, before we went to the sub, we went to every bar in downtown Baltimore and said, hey, we're having a big party, blah, 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 and told everybody to come. So we figured all these people were going to come because now it's like the bars are closing, right? But no, it was not. It was a bunch of nationalist Chinese sailors who were docked next door, and they heard all this music coming, loud rock and roll music coming from the submarine. And the guy, he got, and also Scott, he's the one that got everything, the evening gown guy. He got everything working, the radio working and everything, but he also got the torpedo tubes working, and he wanted a fire on Domino Sugar. Luckily, there were no torpedoes.
So oh my God.
Take out the sugar factory. So we're all drunk and everything. And then the Chinese guys leave. And then we hear more up on deck, and we're thinking, okay, finally everybody's coming. No, it was not. It was the police with a dog. And so we go up, and it's like, oh my God. Then the arson squad shows up because there had been arson fires. And so we're in big trouble. They're going to arrest us for piracy. And they told us that. And it's like, well, we didn't take it out of the harbor. We're still docked. They didn't care. Luckily, Jack knew the guy from the arson squad. And that's how we got out of it.
That is lucky.
But right in the middle of all of this, the news crew from the station where your dad was working pulled up, and I'm thinking, oh, good, this doesn't get any better. Luckily, he wasn't working that night, and it never made the news. So, you know, then I went home, and my mother was waiting up for me. She was so angry. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning, because, of course, before I went home, we all went back to the bar and had another drink. Like, that's what we really freaking did. And I'm telling you, I made up for a time when I was in good shoes in my teenage years. Not so much later on. And she's like berating me and everything. And I just finally stood up, and I was drunker than a skunk. And she goes, I know you've been at one of those cat parties. And I said, no. I told her exactly what happened, and she didn't believe me. So she didn't believe that I almost got arrested for piracy. And so then I went to bed. By this time, it's like I said, it's like 4 o'clock in the morning. I had to get up at 7:30 so I could go to work. And I was still drunk. And so I put on my sister's, they were hanging on the door, even though she, you know, she'd been married and she didn't, you know, it was our old bedroom and they were still hanging on the door. And my sister is substantially shorter than I am. So these, you know, these went way past high water jeans. And some slappy old shirt, and I walk into work, and I was like, oh my God. And I was the one, you know, I was the secretary, so I was supposed to make coffee. And I hear my boss in the office right next to mine extolling my virtues to some guy that's sitting in front of him. And he goes, oh, here she is now. I go in the doorway, and I go, I really feel like shit. Could you please make coffee?
Oops.
Oh yeah, well, you know, he didn't fire me.
Well, okay so then, but now I want to, what would you say was the worst thing I did as a teen?
Okay, well, I'd say the worst Well, I did a bunch of things. I mean, the thing where you took the shrooms after I told you don't ever do something like that when you're far away from home, you did that. But really, it was the report card. That was it.
So, okay, you know, you and I, we're a little fuzzy. I think I figured something out, though. Okay. I think what happened, because I, you know, we were trying to figure out when I did what I did. Yeah. Because I failed three classes, and then I did
the three important classes. Let's make sure that everybody knows you didn't fail.
Well,
we're home at
one was French, so that wasn't that bad. But it was math and science and French.
Yeah.
But so I didn't try to change that report card. I tried to change what it was that there was one report card I got, and I successfully changed it, and you didn't know, and I got away with it. And the reason I know I didn't try to change the one with three fails is because that was from when I went to West High. And I know you got that report card because every summer I would go to Maryland.
Yep.
And you got that report card when I had already left. And yep. So you told
me, where is Kimberly's report card? Why?
No, because this was West High. I didn't change that one. It just showed up and you got it. And then, it was three fails and you saw three fails. And then later,
what I saw was that the report card had, I will never forget.
No, but you're mistaking. I did not change the report card had three fails. I changed a different one. No, I didn't. I didn't change that one.
I have to tell you this, Kimberly. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know, but I'm telling you right now.
I remember what it was
on there, and it was changed in pencil.
I get it. I get it. But you're mistaking the time, because I had changed one that you didn't catch. But then what happened was that was West High. I failed three classes, and then I went to South High, and I think I got a D or two or whatever I got. So I knew I was going to get a D. And so I arranged with this girl. Oh, first I was supposed to go back to Maryland, right? And I knew I was going to get this bad report card. And so I lied to both you and Dad and told them something. I told you guys something. I can't go back to Maryland. I got to postpone it for a week. And whatever I said, you guys bought. So we postponed the trip for a week, but my report card still didn't come. So I had it arranged with this girl that she would drive by every day and check our mail, and she did. And then she got my report card, and she sent it back to Dad's house in Maryland. I changed it. I sent it back to her, and then she put it in our mailbox. And that's what it was, because that was when we lived on Pacific Coast Highway. So it could.
Well, that's true. But yeah. The report card that I remember, okay, there were three, and they were changed in pen and pencil, and you could see, because it was one of those report cards that had, you know, that had you know, it was a stamped report card.
Yes.
And it had
the carbon paper.
So you
yeah.
could see the real grades on the carbon. And I'm thinking, does she think I'm an idiot? Does she think I'm
no? But I got you one day, and I bet it was like in the morning or something when you were going to work, and because there's this thing about you when you were going to work, you just were like only focused on getting ready to go to work. And yeah. So I would just be like, hey, sign my report card. And you're like, okay, bye. And I, you know, it's like, I fooled you once and yeah. that, but I was with you. So I had a little more control, but when you got that report card yourself and you opened it, you could, I mean, and I know I fucked it up too.
Oh, big time. It was unbelievable.
But you know what? Bob changed his report card too. He didn't get three fails.
I never did, because I really was such a goody two shoes.
And you were a good, I mean, I was a good student when I put the, because what happened was when I failed those three classes, my punishment was I had to stay home for a semester. I wasn't allowed to go out. I could have friends over, but I couldn't go anywhere. And you said you have to get A's and B's on everything. And that's it. You're again.
Otherwise,
you're
grounded until next report card.
Yeah. And so I did. I got A's and B's, and which just proved that I wasn't a bad student. Or I wasn't stupid. I was just not a great student. Yeah. And so, but I was also just so like, so preoccupied in the 10th grade. The reason I failed three classes was because, and I'm not even kidding, and you know this, my school was like, I've never, because of you, I went to many schools. And, you know, I don't think there was, for like the whole time that I was in high school and even just grade school and all of it, no school for more than 2 years in a row. So I had many different experiences, but that experience at West High in Torrance, California was like nothing I'd ever seen in my life, because the popularity was like, every school has popular people and stuff, but this was like on crack. And then like the way people would dress, I mean, there was like full blown, like Michael Jackson looking kids walking around and Madonna looking kids. I mean, everybody just like the costumes in that school. And so, and it was funny because I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know how to dress because I was tall. And what looked good on all my friends didn't necessarily look good on me. So I really didn't know what I was doing. It was hit or miss.
There were some kids that thought that you were a teacher.
Oh, yeah. I got that in, I think it was in my senior year, because I looked like I was 26. I was sitting in the classroom in at my desk.
You used to wear some of my clothes there.
Yeah, I would wear your work clothes. I would either wear, well, in the 11th grade, though, when, okay, so I had switched over. So I left the popular school. Like, we, you know, that school was, I had decided after that, I'm like, I cared so much about being popular and hanging out with a popular crowd. I didn't do any of my studies or my homework or nothing. All I cared about was being popular. And I was never popular. I was kind of, I hung with the popular crowd, but I wasn't a popular person. And then, so when I went to the new school, I thought, okay, fuck popularity. Who gives a shit? I'm just going to focus on having fun. And then I was just kind of the real me. So some days I'd go to school, and that was when I was friends with Mickey, and she was kind of goth. So, we called it death rock. So and I was death rock adjacent, because I wasn't really a death rocker. But I would prep, you know, I really have my clip on skeleton earrings and my like purple lipstick and stuff. So I'd wear that one day. And then one day I'd wear like my little, you know, cute little preppy jeans and white tennis shoes. And, you know, and then the next day I would wear your work outfit. It's like, I can't even imagine what people thought of me, because I was so weird. I was just not like other people. I always had friends. And, you know, that's the thing. Let me ask you this, because everybody talks about high school like it's so fucking awful. And I mean, outside of the fact that I was not necessarily the best student, I absolutely had the time of my life. I loved high school. I didn't love school part, but all the social aspects of it, I just enjoyed it immensely. Did you have a good experience in high school?
Yeah, I did. You know, I went to an all girls school, which actually kind of took pressure off of you. Okay. But yeah, I had a really good experience. And I went to Seton High School, which is no longer, but it was a beautiful building on Charles Street in Baltimore. And it was very close to Johns Hopkins University. And one of the things that I just used to love was there was a frat house that was across the street from the school. And every so often on a nice day, okay, we would get a bomb threat. And it was the guys at the frat house, because all of the girls would be evacuated from the school and be all standing out on Charles Street, waving at the boys across the street. And the nuns all knew it, but there was no way they could prove it.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, it was like, let's give those girls a break and ogle them. But I did. And I know one time, what was it? Your dad, he showed up one day and I took him in. Oh my God, that was scandalous. I took him into the all girls school, and I think the nuns brought me and gave me hell for it. But, you know, I never really cared if anybody gave me help. I was a good student, but I've always been the person, I just didn't want anybody telling me what to do.
I guess I got it from you.
Yeah, I just don't, you know, I don't like it when people tell me what to do. It makes me react in certain ways.
Yeah, I inherited it. Yeah. I inherited it because I feel the same way. And I don't think it was just because I saw you and I thought, oh, I'm going to be it. I mean, I got the same instinctual feeling of like, don't fuck with me. That's why, you know, I just have to say my boss, Allison Gill, is suing Doge.
I know.
I swear to God, I love her so much.
Balls the size of the earth.
And you know what? I mean, I have to say, obviously, she and I've been on The Daily Bean. She's been on my show. And, you know, we have a nice rapport and all of this. I wouldn't go so far to call us friends because, you know, we're not picking up the phone and calling each other every time something happens. But I, you know, when she asked me to consider being social media for her, doing social media, you know, it was like, oh my God, that's awesome. Just because yeah. I'm in that group of people. But as it turns out, she's like one of the best. I never like to say I work for people because that's like, it's kind of like that rebellious thing. I work with people, yeah. but I don't yeah. want to say I work for them. But I'm happy to say that I work for her because I think that she impresses me so much. You know, I yeah. mean, the fact that she's suing Doge, the fact that she, I also really admire her temperament because she knows how, I mean, she's got this massive following and it's obviously the following is because of the work she's doing, the way that she delivers her news. But it's impressive to me because I feel like, you know, she and I was going through her Instagram the other day and I was like, oh my God, we have so many things in common because she was goth and I like to say goth adjacent, but yeah, I mean, she was more goth than me. But still, she had that whole thing. She's a cat woman, which I don't have a cat right now, but I've had cats my whole life, obviously. And I know that she was – I know – I saw from her Instagram, I think she supported just like you and I did. Please don't give a shit for this. But we supported Bernie back in 2016. Although we both yeah. supported Hillary. It was – we were not the bros.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was like, you know, she and I have a lot in common. And I just – I feel so incredibly grateful to be working for her because, and like, it's, you know, like I said, usually I will say work with, yeah. but I will say for her, I work for her because I think, you know, she just is one of the most amazing people. She's just amazing. And I love the fact that she has tattoos. She's not always all glammed up. You know, she just says, fuck it. I'm going to go on camera and I'm not putting makeup on and I'm just going to be me. And yeah. I'm just going to talk about things, you know, frank and real. And I just really appreciate that. I just had to throw out my Allison Gill appreciation, you know,
well,
thing
she
on
deserves
my podcast.
It. She really does. I have a lot of admiration for her.
Yeah. Really. I mean, and I, you know, of course I have to mention Stephanie Miller too, because aside, I don't work for her, but yeah. You know, I mean, I'm on her show and I love her and she's fucking hilarious. And she's just so funny. And I feel grateful to be actually, you know, connected to both of those women, because I think, you know, we've got people like the Midas Touch, which I don't know if you know this, but Midas Touch just recently became, I believe, the number one most listened to podcast in America, which is
Whoa.
Awesome. So, yeah. Yeah, that, or at least political. I don't know yeah. if it was the I don't know if it's political or just podcast, but still, it's the number one. They overtook the right wingers. And, you know, so there's just like this group of people that I feel, even though I have nothing to do with them, you know, we're all kind of connected.
Yeah.
And you know, everybody's just out there doing what they can. And I'm just grateful to even be even a small little part of it, just a small little part.
Well, you know what? We're all cogs in a big machine. And the sooner that we realize it, you know, you talk a lot about manifesting and everything.
Yeah.
Cause I know you've got your other channel and we manifest collectively.
Yeah.
As well as individually. You mm-hmm. know, a lot of people, you know, we were talking before and I was saying, you know, a lot of people, they think, oh, you know, manifesting is a bunch of hooey and it's just for people with a lot of time on their hands or people with
privileged
money,
people,
blah,
yeah.
blah, 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 blah. But it really is true. I mean, manifesting is something that we do every single day and it is the decisions we make. And it's as mm-hmm. simple as when you get up, what are you going to have for breakfast?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Are you going to have a bunch of donuts with coffee, with heavy cream and 2 scoops of sugar,
mm-hmm.
all right? And give yourself, you know, wind up to be somebody who is way overweight with the health problems that are associated with that. That's what you manifest,
mm-hmm.
okay? That's a choice that you make, okay? Instead of having, you know, a bowl of fruit and maybe, you know, maybe like a scrambled egg and toast, or if you're, you know, vegetarian or vegan, have, you know, like a high protein oatmeal or a high protein cereal or, you know, something, you know, whatever you like, but something healthy. If you make healthy choices, these are, you know, these are small little things, but these are things that manifest in different ways in your personal life. And on a societal level, you know, I mean, on a societal level, somehow, I don't know what the hell happened, but we manifested Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can manifest him away.
Too. Yeah, we can. I mean, it's a collective. And it's like, I was just going to say voting is manifesting because it's a choice. It's
absolutely.
And it's also, you know, manifesting is, I mean, I don't, the more that I talk about it, it's like, I feel like calling it like creating deliberate experiences or deliberately creating experiences as opposed
yeah.
to, because manifesting makes it sound like, oh, I'm going to wave a magic wand and I'm going to get whatever I want. And that's not what it is. But there is this power that we have in our belief because, you know, I mean, and I'm not going to say his name or what his profession is, but you and I have a friend and I talked about him on the Secret podcast. I call him Andy. And, you know, both of us know this guy. So I'm not just pulling it out of my ass. And he is somebody of, you know, he's religious. He's very religious. And he believes that he's chosen by God. And when I say he believes, it's like, it doesn't matter if I believe it or if you believe it or whatever. He believes it.
He believes it.
And because he has that faith, and it is faith, it's faith in the unknown, he experiences life in a way that looks like he's incredibly lucky. He gets all these breaks. Things seem to fall out of the sky for him. But on the other hand, there is, and I'm not going to mention what it is, but there is something in his life that contradicts his religion.
Yes.
And he doesn't, that plays out for him. It's difficult for him. Like on one hand, his life is just this dream. You know, he's a creative person and you and I both witnessed firsthand, not just creativity or not just work. There was like this
every
one time.
Aspect.
Yeah. There was this one time when we were all going to go get a Christmas tree. And the Christmas tree that you and I liked, and we didn't have a lot of money, it was extremely expensive. And I don't remember what it was, but let's say it was like back in the late 80s.
Yeah,
and you know, it was like $100 tree.
$80. It was really expensive.
And then I don't know what he did, but he got the guy down to like $40.
Yeah.
Which is something you and I would have not even believed we could do.
I know.
It was like we would have just accepted that $80 and thought, okay, we can't afford it. But this guy, Andy, does what he does, and it just, you know, he just brings it down. And that's just a little story. But I mean, he literally has, and I don't want to say what he does because I just don't. But he is a creative person.
Yeah.
And the kind of work that he does, it's so funny because he literally answered an ad in the newspaper and went to China and worked. And, you know, as a creative person, you don't answer things in newspapers to get work. You know what I mean?
It's like, although I will say, what's his doozle? Bob Turk, the weatherman in Baltimore for decades. Okay. He saw an ad in the newspaper that they were looking for a weatherman.
Right.
And that's how he got his job. He hadn't studied meteorology. He just answered an ad, but it really is true. Okay. It's like, our old roommate, Phyllis, rest her soul. She used to have a saying. It's like, wow, did a horseshoe fly up your ass?
Yeah. and with Andy, that's what it appears. But I think really what it is that because he has this assumption that he is chosen, then, you know, then what, It's a combination, I think, of the energy that he puts out into the universe. You know, it's like it comes back to him. And then I think it's just because when you have an expectation, you know, I talked about on The Secret, there was this professor who did a study where it was between people who thought they were lucky and people who thought they were unlucky. And basically the people who think they're lucky, it plays out for them.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just kind of all fascinating. And I'm obsessed with it and I love talking about it. And I've gotten to a point now where I've been studying and exploring and, you know, trying and applying different kind of practices and ultimately have just come up to this easy thing where I'm leaving it up to, you know, you could call it God, your higher self, whatever, you know, whatever you want to call it, where
leave it up to the universe.
Yeah. You set your intention. You have an intention. You don't, you could be very specific about whatever it is that you would like to experience.
And then
you give it, you allow your higher self to orchestrate that path. You walk that path. And then it may not, you know, you may not get, it may not happen the way you think it's going to happen. You could still get what you want to experience, but that experience might come in a way that you couldn't even see. That's why it's better. It's like, don't try to control anything. Just have your intention. Yeah. And then tell, you know, like express it to the universe any way you see fit. And then you kind of drop it, meaning you drop trying to make it happen.
Yeah.
You can still want it. You can, you know,
you just sit back and know, okay, that you've put in your order and now you're just.
And you'll get like in
whatever way it's going to work.
Yeah. Like for instance, you got that download, right?
Yeah.
You got that download about your car.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. Anytime I get some kind of a weird feeling now, I park somewhere else.
Yeah. And it's like you get these little things.
Yeah, you get little fringes.
Yeah. And that's to me, really, I think it's
like, so many times people just ignore them as, this or that or the other thing. Coincidence.
Yeah, but you get I just like to refer to it as your higher self, because it's just lack of a better word. I don't know what it is, but it's that version of the thing we don't understand, kind of giving you prompts and insights. We get insights. I mean, just to end this up, I mean, I've talked about it before, but I'll be brief. I got a download in 1993. And when I say a download, I was in the back of my grandparents' car, and I've told the story a million times, so I will be brief, but I just knew it wasn't words. It wasn't a picture. All it was conceptual knowledge and understanding that there would be a man coming along, and it made me happy. Like I felt like he's not that he would be the one I thought maybe at the time that's what it meant, but it was like, he's going to be a big deal. And then interestingly, I have this kind of like, download, and I remember smiling to myself and feeling really good about it and knowing it, not hoping that it would happen, but just knowing it was a done deal. And then it immediately flew out of my mind, which I believe was intentional. And then 3 weeks later, I had this urge for 2 days to go to this particular place. And then when I went to that place, I met this person who turned out to be a big deal. So I think that, and that's a whole story in and of itself. But, we get these insights and we get urges to do things. So it's like the idea of when you say, all right, I have an intention of whatever. And then, it's not, you don't necessarily have, you do what feels natural. If it feels natural, like if you want a job and you want to go look for a job, go look for a job. But maybe you've got a job and you don't know what you want. So you just kind of leave it to the universe. Because there is a story. There's this woman that her name is Athena Raven on YouTube. And she talked about she had a job. So she wasn't in a situation where it was like a dire thing and she had to get one. So but she had a job and she didn't like it. And she knew that she wanted something different, but she just wasn't sure what it was. There was just a few things that she knew she wanted, like, for instance, maybe how much money she made, maybe the hours she worked or whatever. So she had a little moment where I think she just didn't even get all relaxed or anything. I think she just was focused on the wall for a minute and pictured in her mind being in a place that made her happy, living in the end where it was all worked out for her, even though she didn't know what it was. And then she dropped it. And then a period of time later, I mean, she still wanted it and it was still a desire for her, but she just allowed whatever happened. So she gets this DM from somebody on Facebook one late night, and it was a friend from a long time ago. And they're like, hey, what's up? How you doing? Whatever. They started talking. And then, one thing leads to another. It turns out this guy had the job for her and she wound up getting that job. So she didn't, she just decided that I'm not going to look for it. I mean, it's different if you have to, if you don't have any money and you need a job, then you have to go look for a job. But I mean, if you're in a position where I don't need it right now, I'm just going to put it out there in the universe. And then it's just kind of fascinating. And then you can't be constantly looking for it to say, where is it? Where is it? Where is it? You just got to relax.
Yeah. Because that, relax. That like chases it away, actually.
Yeah. It's because it's energy. And it's like, if you think in terms of people, if somebody likes someone too much,
I know, boy,
that person is pushed away.
It's like opposite, it's like the poles of, the opposite poles on a magnet pushes.
Yeah. You kind of get, it's like, no, you just like that energy of like too desperate or needy or I want, it's like, you just got to chill.
Yeah.
And the chill part is the hard sometimes, but
yes,
I'm learning. I'm learning. All right. Well, I think we're going to wrap this up. But before we go, I want you to tell everyone where to find you and where to find your books, what links to use.
Okay. Well, what I'll do is I will send you, so you can put it at the bottom of this, the link, because, you can find it at Amazon, Apple, Kobo, Barnes & Noble. This one here is only available digitally only because it's so long, you can't make a paperback out of it.
Yeah.
So I'll give you those links, because it is kind of hard. I know there actually is another After the Apocalypse. It's not called After the Apocalypse, the complete series, but it's After the Apocalypse box set or something like that. So, I mean, somebody else, you can't copyright a title. And so if you're going to go look for it, you could just put After the Apocalypse, the complete series.
Ann Werner.
Ann Werner, okay, and that'll pull it up. All right, but I will send those links to you, and then you can put them underneath of, you know, underneath this thing, you know, that we're doing right now. And,
yeah, I'll put them in the show notes.
Yeah, in the show notes. And so, you know, I really hope, you know, I mean, again, okay, there are some people that they don't really like politics, and it's not a lot of politics, okay, in this. I mean, at first, you know, I have my character, President Tower, and, you know, because he was a Trumpian character, but mm-hmm. Really, truly, I mean, it really is, I really went for really what would happen mm-hmm. and how would people deal with having to completely rebuild a society from scratch. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I've had some drive-bys. I think I told you on my last one that somebody said, oh, I knew from page 3, you know, that this is just all, you know, it's liberal preaching. And it's like, no, you know, I mean, it was, how could it be? I had wolves.
Yeah, I know. The first couple pages have nothing to do with anything current at all.
Oh my God. But it was, you know, because it was talked about the melting permafrost. Okay, so, well, it had something to do with climate change, so I had to be a libtard. So, you know, I mean, that kind of a thing. But really, the people who have read my books, I wish more people would actually write a review. I've got, you know, I've gotten stars and everything, but, you know, very few reviews.
Yeah, we all need reviews.
Yeah, they make a big difference. So, you know, if you do go out and buy my book, I really hope that you enjoy it. And the trilogy is basically, if you buy that, okay, it's buy all three, get the first one free. So I just subtracted the price of the melt from the trilogy. So it's $6.98 for 3 books. It's almost 1,000 pages. And, you know, I mean, if you like stories that have, you know, a little bit of woo-woo, all right, which I don't think is woo-woo because I don't think psychic energy is woo-woo. But if you like that kind of stuff, and if you don't mind, you know, a little bit of a statement on society and things like that. But I think, you know, most books incorporate something like that mm-hmm. in one way or another. And, you know, I just think it's an interesting story because I freaking wrote it. But
well, it is an interesting story and it's fun to read. And yeah. All right. And then you are Ms. Werner on Blue
Ms.
Sky.
Ms. Werner, MSWERNER.
Yes. And so if you look up her book, just generally, it's Ann, A-N-N, Werner.
Yeah, the E on the back of that Ann.
Yeah, just straight up A-N-N, and then WERNER. So yeah. There you go. All right, well.
Make me a happy woman.
Buy her a book and give it a good review if you like it. And, of course, it's always fun talking to you, and I'm sure we'll talk soon.
I'm sure we will, too.
All right. Well, thank you, and next time.
All right. Take it easy.
This weekend only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.
Our democracy is hanging by a thread, but we know it's not about just winning and losing each battle. It's about persistence and building resilience.
That's why we're launching the Practivist Pod, the practice of activism made practical.
If you're looking for ways to get engaged or just for ways to stay sane, we want to help you navigate what comes next.
It's an exciting collaboration with political dynamo Jess Craven, author of the Chop Wood, Carry Water newsletter,
and grassroots activist Steve Pearson, host of the How We Win podcast.
Every week on the Practivist Pod, we're going to have important conversations with change makers, give you practical ways to make an impact, have some fun, and inspire hope.
This is more than a podcast. It's a place for our community to grow our practice of advocacy for justice, equity, and progress.
Action is the best antidote for anxiety. So subscribe to the Practivist Pod today.